Claudio, are you there?
I'm here. Good
Hi,
to
it's
hear
just
you.
me. It's just me. It's not Mark. I think there was a little technical typo, but I'm
Okay. It's a
so
pleasure.
happy to find you again after.
Yes. It's been
How are
years
you,
since.
Claudio?
I'm fine. I am aging in this way. I'm getting weaker from the waist down, but it seems to be compensated by getting stronger from the waist up.
I believe you
My
about the
work
waist up.
my work keeps getting better. Every time I do something, is it best time ever I do that. And I'm very happy this year that after so many years of militancy for trying to change education and getting response from the public, but not from the educators so much. For the first time this year, I'm invited to open an international education conference and to do the closure of another one. So it's a year,
Beautiful.
yeah, it's like sprouts from seeds I was not sure would be sprouting in my lifetime.
Okay, a bunch of people listening to this call from all over the world are saying, "Where can we go see you do that?"
It's in Barcelona in October of this year, and the other one is November 23rd, the one where I do the opening. It's a conference
Wonderful.
on education for sustainability, it's called.
I'm so glad to hear that. If anyone has watered seeds well in life, I think more than almost anybody I know, you would be that person. Water them well and wisely.
I keep doing more and more. I'm more active than I ever was in life.
Beautiful. So Claudio, just for those listening, I'm talking to Claudio like a friend because he's been a great mentor and friend for many, many years and been interviewed for most of my books and written forewords for other ones, and I wouldn't really consider embarking on the kind of project that I'm doing now without invoking your wisdom on it tonight, Claudio.
Well,
So
thank you.
that's the context for the call, and what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, is begin by really outlining the project that I'm working on with my partner, Mark Goffney, who's a wonderful spiritual teacher and author as well, and outline the project and set the context for it and really begin to gain your perspective and input, because really what we're doing is a continuation of work that you started pioneering over 40 years ago. Just,
Well,
just one
yeah.
more step, one more piece in the puzzle.
Well, I look forward to hearing how you explain this. I feel we are in the same wave because my first book of all the things I wrote, the first was called The One Quest, which at the time seemed a novel thing, but it's becoming the shared idea of a common ground between all the ways, not just spiritual ways, but between spirituality and psychotherapy and ideally education too.
Yes, well, we're on the same page, but myself, along with many other people, were largely placed on this page due to your influence. So yes, and I've always felt very strongly about drawing on and respecting the forefathers.
Thank you.
So I'd like to actually go back to that book later, but here's the project. So I've opened up, for now it's virtual, but it's going to take form hopefully in the Bay Area starting in January, with Mark Goffney at the Center for World Spirituality. And here's what we're looking at. It seems to us that there's four groups in the world today in terms of spirituality and religion. The first group is people who are still rooted to their religions in a fundamentalist way, in the sense of my religion is the best religion.
That's right.
The next
That's a
group of
clear category.
people are people who have moved beyond the religions because they've unconsciously internalized the modern and postmodern critique of religion, which is that religion and spirituality are irrelevant to me. It's not working.
Yeah.
And then the next group of people that we're looking at are people who feel like they're beyond a specific tradition or don't particularly feel at home with any particular spirituality or religion, but they're deeply compelled and engaged spiritually and are unconsciously piecing together disparate practices and elements so that they can create a world spirituality for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth group of people are what Mark has termed dual citizens, which are people who are still deeply committed to their native or chosen tradition, but they're not held by it exclusively, and they're drawing on many other sources. So, like all the Bujus in the world, and Hindus, and the Yogi Jews, and people who are deeply rooted in a tradition, but don't feel like their particular tradition provides everything they need.
Yeah.
So we're getting to the question for you, the first big question here. But basically, for the tens of millions of people who are post-traditional in the world, new forms of practices are starting to emerge for which you've been pioneering for really 40 years. And your work, in effect, is developing those practices and principles that will serve as the cornerstone for this world spirituality we're developing.
Mm-hmm.
So where I'd like to begin the conversation is to talk about the major practices and principles of your work, as well as the insights that you've gained in, you know, 40, 50, I don't know, I lost count in the last 10 years of your experience in what we're calling world spirituality.
Okay, that's exciting. I'm not sure where I'll begin. Maybe I'll begin by saying that there was a point in my life when I was under the influence of Idris Shah, and he insisted very much that teachers should not wear special robes or speak necessarily traditional language, and he was very critical of big gurus who seemed to be needing the applause of the public too. So when I was invited in Spain to do something that became the international form of the SAT program, when it really became a program, though I had been exploring working with groups and in an integral way from the early 60s perhaps, but when I was invited to do a month-long, three times in successive years, oriented to therapists, I did the same work I had done earlier with seekers, but I presented myself as a therapist,
mm-hmm.
not even as a transpersonal therapist. I did not speak holy language. I didn't speak. It's very much like Idris Shah himself. He doesn't talk about God. He talks about an elephant. He talks about tea. He talks the language of fairy tale, and fairy tale is full of symbols, of course, but he was not even very much into explaining symbols or decoding symbols, but letting them work in the mind. So I have endeavored to not present the figure of somebody who is speaking with borrowed authority from any particular tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I, one of the ingredients of my program has been Buddhist meditation, and specifically the three yanas, one after the other. So, but mostly, even that I've tried to present as a kind of common sense thing that you
mm-hmm.
need to be aware of your ongoing experiences. You need to pacify your mind. That is, I have used a rhetoric which is not traditional rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of forward. Now, the question, I think, was what kinds of practices?
What are the major principles and practices that...
Principles and practices. Well, I see that that can be spelled out from two points of view. One point of view is our levels of being or our different bodies or our different aspects of our being. I was also very influenced by Gurdjieff, who, in speaking of a fourth way, really meant what today is meant by the word holism. He said, mm-hmm. there is the way of action, there is the way of feelings, the way of devotion, there is the way of knowledge, and we will emphasize a fourth factor, being the factor of attention, the factor of meditation, really, even though he didn't use the word meditation, mm-hmm. attention training, you could say, but with an emphasis on working on all fronts. So that has been the blueprint of my work. There is a body therapy dimension to it, also that's not the best word for it. The new somatologists, Tom Hanna used to say, or the old ones too, like Tai Chi and yoga, I've always had that kind of ingredient as a support for everything else I've done. And of course, a mental panorama and intellectual, but I've always tried to de-emphasize time-wise, or present my whatever needs to be understood, to present it very succinctly and a little bit smuggled in the presentation of exercises rather than as a separate body of theory. It mm-hmm. would seem that I'm just doing something experiential. And in the experiential realm, I have emphasized the work on feelings and the work on the spiritual level. And the spiritual, practically speaking, is meditation. And certain help aids to understanding, I use a lot of Sufi stories or tales in general, because they are ways of talking about the developmental process. So those are that's the mandala, that's the four directions of my work, the four traditional ways, mm-hmm. only that in each I distinguish the traditional way, which is right action, and the what I call the negative way, which is the cathartic, coming out with, you could say, wrong action in order to exorcise it, coming out with your action which is not intentionally controlled to be a better person, as when you're cultivating the virtues, but getting out your demons. Mm-hmm. The same in the feeling domain. The traditional feeling domain is the devotional. You try to be more loving. You try to develop the best feelings that are possible to the mind. But, of course, there are demons, and I think one cannot get very far with the growth of love if you don't let the demons out, because only by letting them out can you know them, and only through self-understanding can there be transformation. Can you finally detached from all that. So I in each of these four departments do something which is the traditional, and something that is a little bit the left-handed path extended to all things.
Right. Can you continue with examples? Because I think that by giving the kind of examples you're giving, it gives people a really grounded understanding of these four approaches.
Well, if I think of a typical day when I'm teaching in one of my regular courses, which now my work has come to the format of 10-day long modules. Mm-hmm. I do one a year, and I keep traveling. I have my teaching in many, many countries now. And in each, I do the mornings, and I have collaborators working the rest of the day, usually. Or mostly. And in the typical morning, I begin with meditation. And what I have introduced in meditation is the interpersonal context, meditation in relation, some people call it. When I started this, there was nobody doing it systematically. It was mostly done in initiatory situations where there's a kind of intentional passing on of consciousness from somebody more advanced to. But I am so convinced that meditation is contagious, and not only meditation, but consciousness is contagious in a face-to-face situation, and it has much to do with what happens through the gaze, that I have translated practically all meditation formulas into an IU situation, into a situation where it's not just a matter of making your mind silence while you are looking at a wall or having keeping your eyes closed, but keeping not doing so when you are face to face to another person. And that is an unfamiliar situation in our adult life, except in very intimate situations. Can we let ourselves go blank or be so much in the now, experience-wise, rather than in thinking or in preparing for the next move, as when we are in the middle of a verbal interaction. So I became very interested in this in the early 60s already, because I had trouble in sustained meditation in the ordinary life. Mm-hmm. And I thought one needs to develop a bridge, not just like in monastic situations where people work with their hands and do carpentry or weave rugs and so forth to sustain a contemplative attitude, but face-to-face with another person, beginning with a simple situation which is in silence. Then it can be extended to situations where you're listening to somebody who's speaking, as when you are working psychotherapy. And mm-hmm. then one can have an opportunity of practicing all kinds of meditation that can, in a way, influence the person who's speaking to go more into, let's call it noble silence. If you are talking to somebody who is not just silence, but is in a kind of self-aware silence, in a meditative silence, then you find it very difficult to speak about trivialities. If you are with somebody who has a depth to that quality of silence, you are invited to become more meaningful. And there is a kind of silence. I remember Fritz Perls was another strong influence in my life. He was very difficult to be around, and it was very common to be around him in the Esalen days, at the days, the hours of meals. It was like a continuation of therapy, even if he didn't say anything, because he was so aware that somehow you came without words, aware that he was aware of you, and it was like being beaten by your foolishness, or being called on your your wrong attitude. So I have taken advantage of this situation where people are silent before each other, and mm-hmm. silence begins to form a loop. Silence is a kind of feedback loop. I was very inspired by Buber's writing, of course, in this, and also by Gurdjieff. The title of his last series, last writing was "The World Is Real When I Am."
Therefore, I am. Yeah.
So the other is real when I am, and but I am also when I can make room for seeing the other. It works both ways. Our being, we are made present when we are present to another. So that's been one of my creative fields, let's say. It comes to mind in response to your question of mm-hmm. the exercises I have created or have. That's an area of exercise I have been developed. I could go on, but maybe you want to.
One thing that I'm struck with, Claudio, is that as we articulate this vision of world spirituality, the first thing that was very clear to us is that we're not articulating a new principle. And the reason that it's so appealing to people, I mean, I'm receiving webcast questions. We're not going to get to them until 8 o'clock, but before you even got online, questions were coming in from literally all over the world. But I think that the idea or the articulation of world spirituality is speaking to what's already happening in the world. And when you talk, I also know quite a bit about your background, I'm struck that you're both deeply traditional in the sense that you've done deep study and are connected to and rooted in, you know, a number, but deeply, a number of traditions, and you're incredibly radical and attending to Western and South American culture and the time and place that we're in right now. It's like you're an example and an exemplar of the very principle of world spirituality in your articulations of your work. So I'm
When I came to Tartan Tungpa Rinpoche in the, when was it, in the early 70s, 71, I believe, I started to be under his influence. He said to me, integrate everything you have learned with what you will be learning now. From the very beginning, he seemed to have seen in me somebody who had the vocation of an integrator or a function of an integrator. And I felt very fortunate to not be antagonized in my natural tendency because he made me feel very much at ease with that. I had had contact with shamans. I was lucky to learn some from the successor of this 72nd Taoist patriarch. Not the successor, but a student of this patriarch. So I had many, many sources, and I had tried to bring them even to my early SAT program in the Berkeley days, but I found that it's not a way for everybody to be a hummingbird taking from here and from there. It makes things in some way more difficult.
Right.
But this happening, as you say, in the culture. In that regard, I would say that what I find most meaningful in what is happening is that everything we call religion is either patriarchal. Religions have a mother component and a father component.
Mm.
By mother component, I mean love. But religion is not mindful of love, or does not share the ideal of, or the experience of spiritual evolution as an evolution towards compassion and love, universal love. That's generally acknowledged, and that's the mother side of us. But religions look mostly heavenward, and that is. And partly it's like the gesture of a Gothic cathedral with its upward-pointing spire. It's a longing for something we conceive as an ideal or something we imagine. We have ideas of the divine. We have conceptions of the divine, of spirit or enlightenment. And this combination of having images or concepts about what is our goal, plus the longing for it, is transformative. It's one of the ways. It's one of the things that moves us forward. Is devotion, in other words. So devotion and mother love and compassion are very much present in all religions. But what is not present and what is generally antagonized in traditional religion is what I call the Dionysian component, the element of not only freedom, but the element of joy and spontaneity, the trust in impulses, the trust in instincts, ultimately, the trust in one's animal nature. Shamanism has that, but religions lost it long ago with the beginning of patriarchal society. Dionysian religion was the earliest of the Greek religions, but then Dionysus became a kind of rebellious god. Oh no, marginal god. Even the story of the god reflects that it came very late to Olympus. And interestingly, the myth of Dionysus says that there he came to sit at the right hand of the Father. Christianity obviously borrowed that from the myth of Dionysus. So there's a lot of resemblance between Christ and Dionysus, the god that dies and is resurrected. But the difference is pleasure. The old Dionysian religion was a religion of letting go, and the access to the divine was through letting go. And that has subsisted only in shamanism and in the psychedelic culture, the sense of that being a path. But it's quite antagonistic to traditional concepts of religion, because the traditional concepts are very much supported by an ethics, and the ethics involve control and knowing what you do and having a clear idea of what is good and what is not good, rather than letting go, where you cease to be interested in knowing what will come out of you. So I think the Dionysian aspect of the path was rediscovered under a new label. It started to come out with Freud, not so much Freud, who just showed that we are sick because we are not in line with Eros. We have chosen the reality principle over the pleasure principle. But Reich, who came after, and others who came after, like D.H. Lawrence, who became the champions for Eros, and Marcuse, who wrote Eros and Civilization. So I think that is being undone. The level of repression over instincts is being healed by psychotherapy. It started with psychotherapy, but now it's beyond psychotherapy. It's part of the spirit of the culture. It was very much the spirit of the 60s. You could say, like Sam Keen, the theologian, he wrote a book on the 60s called To a Dancing God, acknowledging the presence of the Venetian element there. So that's a great synthesis, I think, that is happening in the culture. The synthesis of the way of liberation that has mostly been championed by therapy, and the way of traditional spirituality.
Okay. You have given rise in me to about 15 critical questions, and I'm going to discipline myself to prioritize them and still leave time around 8 o'clock for the people writing in. So here's what I want to talk to you about next. One of the critical points in the effective articulation and living out of a world spirituality is going to be discernment. So when we talk about your function as an integrator, in order to right, the danger of world spirituality is that people are going to pick and choose, go wherever they want, become spiritual dilettantes, and end up with something muddled and ineffective. Right? That's what a lot of the traditions would tell us.
Yeah.
Now you trust yourself and are a trustworthy vessel to integrate. Now, I can imagine that as people start to sense and see that this world spirituality is a possibility, and they say, yes, that's me, because I'm in one of these categories. I'm a dual citizen, or I'm deeply spiritual, but I don't belong to any tradition, and I don't want to get lost, and I don't have the same breadth and body of experience that Claudio has to fully trust myself in knowing how to integrate. So the question for you would be guidance in the articulation and living out of a vision of world spirituality, guidance for discernment, and
yeah.
how to trust ourselves, not just how to trust ourselves and be trustworthy to ourselves.
Yes. In that first book of mine, I say at some point that my business is not to recommend this or that path, because in the matter of choosing, it's like in marriage that you get what you deserve. I think there is today a kind of still a new age feeling about spirituality, in do-it-yourself, an anti-authoritarian stance that envisions a spirituality without teachers, a spirituality without the authority given to the wife in traditional religions. And I think it's very difficult not to throw out the baby with the bathwater in the matter of authority and authoritarianism. Because, of course, religions have become authoritarian to the extent that they have become religions rather than spiritual schools. Every spiritual school has crystallized around it a religion, which is a semi-political creation or reality.
Mm-hmm.
So we would like to get rid of religion, and it's easy to for people to go along with a kind of democratic or pseudo-democratic ethos and saying, we, the modern people, don't need the teacher-student relation, which is based on authority. Mm-hmm. We are democratic. We know better than that. That's a residue of the past. I personally have been very much guided by my own intuition, but I have believed in what my heart tells me, but my heart has told me to go to this guru and to that guru, and I have always been very respectful of the experts along the path and to learn with them and then follow my way when it's necessary, when it's pertinent. So I think that's a delicate issue, and one should make a plea, or one should make the culture aware for the functionality. Just like when you are in the street of a new city, and you don't hesitate in asking for directions when you want to know how to get to a place, you don't invoke the need for doing it yourself, and you take it for granted that there are some people who know better than you certain things, like in this case, the layout of the city. So the same with everything, learning languages, learning music, you need teachers. And this is not to say that there are not self-taught people. Even in the spiritual world, there are shamans who make it on their own. There are people who are touched by grace, who are visited from above, so to say, who are inspired. But full development without teachers, I think, is a rarity, an exception. It is very, there's so much that can be learned, and I think it's a misconception that one should get rid of. It's kind of stereotype that everything should be egalitarian. It's like perpetuating a situation of the blind leading the blind.
Right.
If you are not able to accept a teacher because the teacher insists that he can see what you cannot see, then you are stuck with the blind. You can only accept a teacher who probably has no better offers or something like that. Somebody who's so much needing to have students that will accept you. So I know people who go to mediocre teachers because it's against their principles to go to teachers who are too insistent on their knowing or their traditional ways.
Right.
So that's essentially the discrimination is something that cannot quite be taught. I was once in a conference on conversion and there were this on religious new religious groups in the sometime in the 60s in the 70s I think it was organized by Jacob Needleman and others, and there was a kind of search for what are the characteristics of a true guru. And there are gurus who say a guru should be like this or like that. Muktananda used to say a guru should have no other business but God. A guru should have realized what he's teaching in personal experience. And you could make lists like that. But I think the more lists you make, the more the people will mimic what those lists describe. And the false teachers will feed on that information of how a guru should be.
Right.
Everything can be falsified. So you can't do away with the need for a good nose. And a good nose comes from good karma, or from having worked on yourself, of having become less childish and less naive, less in need for binding to the wrong teacher or with the wrong motivations. There's a lot of self-deception that takes you to situations where you're going to be deceived.
Right. So you're articulating something subtle and critical, right? You're calling on the people to trust themselves deeply.
You need to be a sincere seeker if you are going to find what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
The sincerity of motives. You have to make some progress in truthfulness to yourself, and if you're going to have that kind of discrimination which you are asking about.
Right. And I also appreciate that you bring up in this mix the need for teachers, right? Of course, there's discrimination in the need for teachers, but just because there's a need for discernment doesn't deny the relevance of teachers and strong teachers, even as we're learning to integrate and synthesize for ourselves.
Yes.
So I'm going to turn the question a little bit because I feel like we could talk all night. I remember one time I went to your house to interview you for an hour and left, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours later. That was that first interview for Halfway Up the Mountain. But there's a couple more points I want to definitely make sure we touch upon. And that is that among the variables that you're integrating, right, two of the ones that you've done the most significant work on in terms of the Western world and world spirituality is spirituality or meditation and psychotherapy, in addition to other variables. So I would, and of course you're one of the founders of transpersonal psychology itself and so forth. I'd like it if you would be willing to walk us through the basic principles and practices of meditation, which you started at the beginning of this call, and walk us through the basic principles and practices of psychotherapy, and then talk about how they relate to each other.
Okay. Well, speaking of meditation, I see that both operationally at the level of techniques and at the level of the inner state of the meditative mind, you could say meditation is not a single thing, but is a multifaceted thing. The mind in meditation has different facets, and different forms of meditation emphasize one or another of these facets that are not contradictory. And they lead to a deeper or to a more encompassing thing than what the word seems to evoke. For instance, stilling the mind. That's a very important aspect of meditation. Ekagrata, and you know the Sanskrit term, one-pointedness.
Mm-hmm.
It's basis of yoga, and it may be effortful to not do what we are conditioned to do. It's like swimming against the stream, but there comes a point where the mind has learned to find a peace, and then it becomes like the force of gravity. You fall into restfulness. So peace and quiet and, or in the Christian vocabulary, silence, which is said to be the path to communion. That's one very very widespread form, quality of meditation in many cultures. You would say that silence is the very opposite of letting the mind do what it wants. Because when you begin to practice immobility, not only of the body, but of the thinking mind, it takes effort, it takes discipline. The word mind control has arisen from that effort. Mm-hmm. And there was a conference I attended many years ago in Topeka, Kansas. Menninger Foundation organized something, a conference on voluntary control of mental states or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think voluntary control was in it. So there is silence, there's quiet. But it's also part of meditation to let the mind or let life or let the mind stream do its thing spontaneously. And it's not so emphasized in many of the traditions. Like in Buddhism, it's not a part of the implicit or the explicit classification of meditation forms. In Buddhism, there's a shamatha, which is stillness, and there's vipassana, which is the understanding of the mind and or some certain understanding of certain facts about experience in general. It has to do with insight. But there is not a group of meditations that have to do with letting go. And yet it's there, like in the act of refuge. What is it to adopt that posture of refuge, which is like the Muslim prayer posture, but it's already the body's invitation to surrender. Surrender is completely the opposite of holding the mind still and saying, I am controlling my mind. It's like saying to something bigger than yourself, I get out of the way. Mm-hmm. You're not monitoring yourself. You're not following a formula. In the moment when you surrender, you surrender. You just dissolve. So that's part of what I call the Dionysian ingredient. And it's part of meditation, even of the when the task of doing nothing seems to be on the surface. Like in Zen, there's this common observation, traditional saying that is almost proverbial, that you need to make your mind empty like the sky so that the clouds can course through it. Mm. There's one part of you that becomes like nothing, like becomes like space, like becomes still, so that... That's permeability that is created through that becomes a transparency to the life process. So a Zen master is not somebody who is just forcing everything out of his mind like neti, 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 neti. Mm-hmm. In some way it is like that. Mu is precisely that, working the core. But the state achieved is a state where finally you are not there, but life is there. Your ego disappeared, but the whole life process has taken its place. You might say that meditation is 50% dying and 50% living. It's working in both directions. Mm-hmm. You become alive to the present and you become receptive to experience. And that's why meditation is a preliminary to Kung Fu and other martial arts, because you have to be there, not only to your inner mind, to be there to the other person who might strike you down if you're not there. It's all attentive, but not in a way not there, in the sense that it's not an I that is there. I like very much a Spanish saying. We have a saying about a fly that's sitting on the plow and says, see how we're plowing. So mm-hmm. it is like as if our little egos are saying, look at me, look at the life I'm leading, look at what I'm doing.
Right.
And the more we grow, the more we see the absurdity of our little ego taking credit for what is, at when we are at our best, we are just permeable to life doing itself through us.
Right, right.
So there I have been speaking about a complementarity. At the conceptual level, stilling the mind is the opposite of letting the mind flow. And there are meditations that are mostly stilling the mind, and it gets to be very dry if it's only that, or letting the mind flow, which is states of trance, where you are open to anything that wants to happen. And you can have visions, you can have movements, you are open to a rather mysterious process which leads to phenomena of inspiration and the phenomenon of possession, like when the prophets of old spoke and didn't know what would come out of their mouths, and they were possessed by the Holy Spirit. So I say that these are two facets that seem to be an opposition, but are a complementarity, not a contradiction.
Right.
And that, I say, is one, I've never used the word principles of meditation, but I call it a mm-hmm. dimension of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
It could just, you could say silence is a principle, and you could say letting go is another principle. And they are at the antipodes of a dimension, which is the dimension of doing. Either you not do, the way of not doing, Wu Wei, or you let the flow of life pass through you. And ultimately, it comes to be the same thing as in those Chinese watercolors where you typically see a very tiny figure of a man in a boat. And it's as if the immensity of the landscape makes us aware of this sensation, inner sensation of being dwarfed by life. And in a condition where you're not doing anything, but your boat is carried by the flow of the river. So that's, I say, a dimension of meditation. But there is another dimension, which is the cognitive dimension, the dimension of attention. You could say, if meditation is either not doing or letting doing happen by itself, you could also say that meditation is paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And meditation is paying attention to what? You have an alternative. You can either pay attention to the facts of experience, to the ingredients of experience, like in ordinary vipassana, South Indian, Sri Lanka vipassana, as it's mostly taught, you are aware of your breathing, you are aware of sitting on your buttocks, you are aware of your right arm, you are aware of the air coursing through your nostrils and so forth. And you may direct this to any area of experience. You may direct it to being aware of thoughts, being aware of feelings, being aware of impulses. This is one kind of awareness directed in some way outwardly. But you can also direct awareness, you try to reach to the core of your being,
mm-hmm.
to the center of your experience. What is at the center? There's something that in the Indian tradition it's called I, or self, rather more exactly, though Ramana Maharshi used the word I, who am I. The tradition is called the self. And other traditions prefer not to call it the self, like Buddhism prefers not to call it at all, or to talk about emptiness being the deeper reality. So it's a different exercise. And this exercise of reaching for the center has still another form, which is not quite investigating the core of your being, but trying to reach to the core of your being through a conceptual or symbolic intermediary.
Mm-hmm.
You can try to reach the center of being through the evoking of holiness, or the invocation of deities, and you can reach for meaningfulness. And there is it's an area where meditation comes to fade into the domain of devotion. It looks like even Patanjali in the sutras, in the Yoga Sutras, when he was talking about resting your attention in dharana, or before dhyana, prolonging your attention on a given focus, what was meant was the chakras, and traditionally chakras were always regarded holy. So it was not just putting your attention on a pencil or putting your attention on a drop of ink, mm-hmm. but there is an element of putting your attention on holiness and an implication of holiness that is a part of your motivation to intensify your attention, but also it's kind of foretaste of what you will find in the end, because of course development leads more and more to the sense of holiness, or the appreciation for holiness. Mm-hmm. Just like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but there are beholders who have very little of that kind of eye. We have not, in the modern world, not much sense of holiness, even if we may have the emptiness that we would like to fill with something meaningful, and we may try to fill it with rock and roll or with art or literature or movies or whatever.
Right, right. So I'm just aware that that I've asked you a big question, and we're gonna need to take some questions soon. But then when we just moving from the meditation, and I also wanted people to know that Claudio came out with a beautiful book a few years ago called The Way of Silence and The Talking Cure. So if you have the feeling like I do that we're just getting started, and how are we gonna complete this in this interview, the answer is that we're not. But it's a wonderful book that's addressing this. But can we turn for a few moments to an integration of the meditation that you're talking about with psychotherapy, and obviously you're talking about a psychotherapy that's not entirely separate from meditation, and right on the cutting edge where it's for me it's hard to say that hard to separate out the spirituality and psychology. But could you talk to us a little bit about that integration?
Well, in the first place, there is a common ground between both fields. There's certain things that cut across both things. And there's ways in which meditation and psychotherapy are complementary. For one thing, meditation is something you do by yourself and for yourself, whereas psychotherapy allows for something like a blood transfusion, allows for another person coming into your awareness and stimulating your awareness. Another person can make you go faster by making you aware of things you didn't notice about yourself, or facilitate the process of your expression, so you come to see yourself better because you are coming out of hiding in a way. So in some ways, for a second, speak about integration is the simple fact that it's a good idea to have both. Mm-hmm. And this is not something that was acceptable by many spiritual schools even a short time ago. I was, for instance, part of the Gurdjieff work. And I remember people were not accepted in the Gurdjieff work if they had not solved their therapeutic process in problems. If they needed therapy, they were not ready to enter the work, as was the language of the times. I was also in psychoanalytic training, and in analysis, if you had spiritual interests, it was considered a symptom. It was something you should be cured about. There was nothing to seek outside of the province of psychoanalysis. So in that sense, of course, psychoanalysis was just as hegemonic as any old religion. It's part of the Western spirit of the patriarchal world. But let's see, speaking of principles, you mentioned that question, what
right,
would be the
right.
principle of therapy? I would say that one of the basic ingredients of psychotherapy is self-understanding, self-knowledge. Seeing ourselves makes us free of ourselves. Or seeing our old games makes us able to leave them behind. Seeing our destructiveness makes us not to want it. Seeing how stupid we are makes us at our best, able to laugh at ourselves. It's a better cure than intentional virtue. Because if
right.
we're trying to be honest, if we're trying to not be angry, if we're trying to not be narcissistic, there's always two at war in that process of trying.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you really see something stupid about yourself and see it thoroughly, if you see how crazy it is to have lived most of your life really believing that if you are not perfect, you don't deserve to exist, for instance. How many people live like that? Many people believe they're not worthy of being loved, and they're not worthy of loving themselves if they are not perfect. And they have not quite realized the obvious fact that nobody can be perfect just by willing it here and now. The cosmos here and now is the only way it can be. It's we are living in a lawful universe, and what we are now is the result of what we were yesterday. And we can have the best ideals, and there is a place for ideals and aspirations in life, but ideals are not to be confused with commands to ourselves to be like that right now. So everybody carries a crazy idea within that is to be gotten rid of, though it's not so simple to come to that openness and that honesty where we can see our stupidity. So in fact, only rather mature people are the ones who can say, I was mistaken. Most people can see themselves as neurotic, but have not gone deep enough to see themselves as psychotic. I think behind every neurosis there is a hidden psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
We're really crazy, and there are ideas we harbor that are worth laughing at if we could just see them. And only a few people, in the statistically speaking, are able to say, there was a time in my life when I discovered I was wrong. I had been living on the basis of the big error. The people who have seen the core of the neurosis can say that. Some people who have lived for fame and success sometimes realize how ephemeral, how stupid it is to waste one life in vanity, how it's not a vision of things that can be sustained in the nearness of death. That's why death has such a curative effect on the nearness of death. It gets us rid of some of our stupidity. But how did I get into this? I forgot now.
We were
principles
talking about
of therapy. Self-understanding. Self-understanding one's ego. Understanding one's ego, understanding one's personality, understanding one's programming, understanding the history of one's life, understanding one's life and one's relationships. That's all the field of self-understanding. In the old days, there was also a religion of self-understanding. In Greece, it was the Apollonian religion. It was like the counterpoint of the Dionysian. Apollo is the god of seeing things right, It's a God that sees from the distance and shoots his arrows at monsters. When we can't look at ourselves from the distance, we can kill our inner monsters. We can see our inner monsters, our inner demons, however you call them, our passions,
mm-hmm.
our faults,
mm-hmm.
our lower nature, or like the Dalai Lama calls them, our destructive emotions, the kleshas, the hindrances of traditional spirituality. They are the destructive emotions, and we need to get out of that prison, and to some extent we can get out through the discipline of practicing certain attitudes like in the Gurdjieff work, the rhetoric was to inhibit the expression of negative emotions, to inhibit the expression of pride, anger, and such things. And so that's helpful to create new habits. But ultimately, it's self-understanding that does it. And without getting this distance from all the old condition, it's very hard to let the essential self unfold. And in other words, to let our love, our potential for loving, unfold. And I think, speaking of spiritual principles, I would say that my newest way of grasping our essential nature at the level that is articulated, that not at the level of nothingness, of course, at the level where there's nothing that can be said because it's not in the map, in the conceptual map. But I work very much with the blueprint of that we have three qualities of love in us. Mm-hmm. We have mother love, which is compassion, empathy. We have father love, which is aspiration to the heavenly things, love of heavenly things, a love of ideals, you might say. It doesn't have to be called love of God. It can be love of justice, love of truth, love of many things. And the eros. Eros is one form of love, enjoyment, which can be the enjoyment of simple things as in childlikeness, or it can be the enjoyment, bliss, in the highest states of ananda, in spiritual states. But if you don't have freedom for erotic enjoyments, you're very unlikely to get to heavenly enjoyment either, because it's like two levels, two octaves of the same organ.
Right.
So I'm working very much with the blueprint. In terms of principles, I talk about the father principle, the mother principle, and the child principle related to our three brains. And so I would say we need a spirituality not only for the neocortex or for our mammalian relational brain, but we need a spirituality that honors the inner animal, which is also the inner child.
Thank you. Yes. Claudio, we're going to need to turn to a couple of the webcast questions that our listeners aren't disgruntled. But before that, I just want to make a brief announcement for our listeners, because many of them have been following our series, and that is that on July 21st to 25th, we're going to do our first World Spirituality Retreat. It's an urban retreat in Sausalito. Of course, you are always welcome, Claudio, to come to anything we do. But the retreat is going to be... I'm sorry?
Oh, I was going to ask you to repeat the dates.
July 21st to 25th in Sausalito.
I'm sorry. I won't be in the country.
Okay.
In Germany by then.
Too bad, because... The 40 slots that we have available, which are almost full, probably would have been full before the end of the call. but it's going to be a wonderful urban retreat with myself, Dr. Mark Goffney, Sean Asbjorn Hargens, Jonathan Gustin from the Integral Awakening Center, Clint Fuse. And we're going to really get into the retreat and these principles and the practices of world spirituality. And we're going to practice in the city and in this relational way that Claudio is speaking to, and as well as meditation and yoga and interpersonal. So I just wanted to let people know that that's going to be happening and that it's almost full. So we want people to be able to sign up before we sell out.
Yes.
And now, Claudio, I'd like to turn our attention to webcast questions. This has been the first interview I've done where the questions started coming in before the interview started. So the first one is Nadia, who wrote in from Switzerland. And I like her question because I've been hearing this question consistently since we started the teleseries about a month ago. Nadia says, Claudio, I've been following the conversation about world spirituality as well as your work, and I'm also very interested in your views on education. I have a 4-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son, and I want to educate them in a way that is in accordance with this model of world spirituality and with Sat and these principles. Where do I begin?
Gurdjieff used to say to people in his circle, the best thing you can do for your children is work on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of life, I have repeatedly thought how true that was, because I have found myself giving all kinds of advice. Of course, one should love one's children, one should be careful about expressing criticism in a way that's as respectful as possible. One should give them space for their the building up of their decision making, and follow. Be sure you're not inhibiting their spontaneity too much, and you should listen to them, etc., etc. But in the end, ideas don't go so far as we would want them to go,
mm-hmm.
because people have limited ability to do different from what they're doing.
Right.
To some extent, we are bound to be as we are. So the best thing is to work on our being. And this has been shown very visible, demonstrated by, Daniel Siegel? Daniel Siegel is an educator and a neurobiologist. I think he's other things too. I saw him at a conference with the Dalai Lama some years ago in Germany. He wrote a book that I recommended to a publisher in Spain, and it was published there. I don't remember the original title, but it was translated in Spanish as How to Be a Good Parent. And the central idea is that if you are becoming more aware, if you are working on yourself, that has enormous repercussions in the kind of dialogue you have with your children, the kind of communication, how children perceive you. It's incalculable. So one should have trust in that and perhaps not burden oneself it's very good to have that question in mind, to have that view in mind. But I think the answer is essentially to go through being the best kind of person you can.
Right, right. Great. Thank you, Claudio. Another question. There's many, many questions coming in about the Enneagram, naturally. I think because the focus of our conversation tonight is about world spirituality, I'm going to stick with some of those questions. And here's a beautiful question from Adriana in Cochabamba, Bolivia. And she says, Dear Claudio, for those who haven't got the opportunity to be at the Sat trainings yet and be able to discover about their attachments and egoic structures, can you recommend any other useful practices? Sadly, meditation in most South American countries is a practice that most of us have little acquaintance with.
The question
from Adriana.
The question is to say more of meditation or to say
no, that
about
that
other
because
things, other
they, things. She doesn't have the chance to discover about their attachments and egoic structures and to do the SAT training. Can you recommend useful practices or where to begin? the processes that you're talking about?
Well, I frequently recommend that people begin by writing the story of their lives, to writing a good autobiography. An autobiography of the facts, but the facts not only of outer life and the story of relationships with the most important people in life, but the facts of inner life too. And if you do commentary to those facts, keep the commentary in present tense, like a retrospective commentary, and keep the commentary in balance with the proportion you give to the facts. Mm-hmm. I think that leads to many findings, leads to realization of any patterns. Then when you are working on that autobiography, you should pay very special attention to your pain in childhood and your anger in childhood. Because the most important moments where you were wounded, the most important moments when you were indignant at one or the other of your parents, probably left traces in you that explain a lot about you. In writing this biography, I'm thinking aloud now, I would say you could also try to individualize the personality traits of your parents and of yourself as the story unfolds. There's a moment, for instance, when you decided, I will never say, show my the truth of my experience again, because I've been very hurt and betrayed. It's better to keep one's truth to oneself. Right. And so you acquire from that moment a character trait of hiddenness or of you wearing a mask or whatever. So it's an interwoven story of facts and the formation of personality. Then, speaking about understanding one's personality, of course, it has been a visible, unplanned experiment in our culture. It has been demonstrated by nobody in particular how important the Enneagram is to people, how important it is to understand human types. Human types have always existed, and all good literature describes characters, and the first person who described characters systematically was Theophrastus, a disciple of Aristotle. At the age of when he was 100 years old, he wrote a book on the characters, which he describes 50 kinds of, not different kinds of people, there's some redundancy. But you find many of today's subtypes of the Enneagram there. Uh-huh. And they are not so clearly formulated as anybody writing about the Enneagram today can do. It's just like as if the refinement in the description of character has come to a point where people can do in a rather abbreviated manner something that Gurdjieff considered very important, which is determine what is your chief feature. Determine what is the pivot around which your personality dynamic revolves. Today we have DSM 4 or 5. I don't even know. I haven't caught up with it. But characters are generally described, only described as a sum of traits, characteristics. But there is the missing, the psychodynamic element. What's the central thing? Is there and I think it is very true what the early Christians knew, what the fathers of the desert knew. But it's not essentially a Christian tradition. I have shown that you can find the seven sins, of course, are not in the Gospels. They come only into writing in the 4th century by a man called Fabius Ponticus. But I have found them in a poem by Horace, 1st century, contemporary of Jesus. Horace was aware of the of the seven sins and their respective virtues.
Wow.
So this has come from an esoteric tradition of old. And even though there's been great refinement today, I would say. And it's many people take that step. It's not the same thing as to make a diagnosis of oneself as knowing oneself. But it's like the difference between labeling a bottle and tasting its contents.
Mm-hmm.
So saying my type is envy, even though it may be very true that at the time of a crisis, spiritual crisis, you will suffer from envy, and maybe in the bardos you will be in the purgatory of the envious, as if Dante Alighieri shows it. Even if that may be very true, but it's not enough to know that. But in some people, that is enough that life begins to teach you the meaning of that. You begin to observe daily, not just envy in relations, but you begin to observe the experience of envy in your subtle world, in the emotional level. So self-understanding takes observation, not just a map. But the combination of a map with observation is a good thing. One should practice vipassana. One should look into oneself. What do I experience now? And be able to connect what you find in your daily experience through repeated observation, through taking snapshots of oneself, so to say, to be able to relate that to the map. See, what kind of emotion dominates in my inner life?
Yeah. It's particularly moving how you're describing this, right? Because I've spent a lot of time working in Spain, and you know, there's thousands and thousands of people there who have really found the path, the spiritual path and the path to emptiness through the Enneagram. And then I can imagine that for many years you've heard so many people say the critique you just addressed to it. You know, I don't want to label myself and be reduced to that, but almost from a world spirituality perspective, you're demonstrating how that map and how the psychological domain and territory can also be the very root and completely interrelated to the experience of emptiness or spirit or whatever we're going to call it.
That's right. To me, it was a surprise that all this became so important. When Oscar offered to pass on to me his specialty, I was not excited by it because I was after enlightenment and not about understanding about the Enneagram. And even after when he sent me that retreat, that was the main experience of my life, that changed my life, I started to understand things better. I was not excited. It was like a hobby, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of that hobby became the first descriptions of the types, which Oscar had not provided. And from the filtering of that first group in Berkeley came the people who began to teach the Enneagram and who created a whole community. And I continue to regard it in my own work as just one ingredient in a mosaic.
Mm-hmm.
But with time, I must say that people tend to feel that it's been the center of that mosaic, in spite of my intention of not making it so salient, so much the foreground.
I was just going to say that one thing that I've been aware of as I've been exposed to the people who practice your work in Spain and who have studied with you is that because of the context of who you are, that comes in the transmission of that aspect of the mosaic. So in some way, this aspect, which is the Enneagram, which some people use as a much more straightforward psychological tool, the people that have studied it and received the transmission of it in the context of your teaching, whether or not from you directly, end up receiving the larger taste of the spiritual context behind it.
I think that's very true, because it's the only way I can explain that my work gets so much better as time goes by, even though I am teaching the same things.
Yeah.
It must be my inner growth somehow is reflected, creates mm-hmm. a kind of aura. It creates a field of contagion.
Yes, yes.
If I grow, people around me grow too.
Yes. So I'm gonna ask you our final question for this round. I definitely, Claudio, I'll speak to you about it later, but would really like to access you in terms of the book that Mark and I are writing on this subject, because I really feel like you've been doing this work for over 40 years, and we're just scratching the surface. But one of the imminent projects, because we're going to localize our center in the new year, is that a lot of people are coming to World Spirituality when they have young children, kind of like the woman who wrote from Switzerland. And they're coming because maybe they're finding their way, putting things together, but they want somewhere for their children to go. Right? They don't feel like they can join the temple or the church, but they don't want to not go anywhere. They want to belong to something. They want community. So we definitely plan to open up a World Spirituality child care program, which could certainly lead to a preschool. And today, when I was just getting excited about interviewing you and thinking about our World Spirituality preschool, I'd like your certainly your blessing, but guidance. So I certainly heard you say, of course, we have to work on ourselves, but what, how we want to educate our children in terms of World Spirituality?
Well, I think that's a wonderful project. There's somebody in Spain I've been suggesting, to whom I have been suggesting over the years, why don't you create a summer camp, children's summer camp, with the kinds of things we do in the SAT program,
mm-hmm.
but only that translated to children's level. I think there should have be a strong physical component. Children are into movement. With more emphasis on awareness than sports are usually in the way they are taught, even though the highest representatives in the world of sports are into that inner side of tennis or golf and what not, and swimming. Awareness, physical awareness, but not excluding stillness too, because I have been hearing about a number of centers where children are taught stillness, traditional meditation, like mm-hmm. Sogyal Rinpoche has a center where people around him are doing that, and I've heard what they report, and it's very good. And of course, young lamas are taught that way, and they learn. It looks like just as children can learn about electronic games much better than us, they can learn inner arts also better than art or languages. So silence can be included, and meditation can be included, but in different ways. It can be connected to stories where you visualize what is being heard or told. I think spontaneity is very important too. Like, even though children seem to be spontaneous, there's a kind of subtle listening to what you really want to do. For instance, the practice of what is today called authentic movement. I don't know whether you mm-hmm. are aware of that. Few people know about it. It came mm-hmm. from dance. It came from Jungian... who brought in a little bit of a Jungian perspective into the field of movement. It can be conceptualized many ways, but essentially the same as the old practice of Subud, the Latihan. You just don't move until something happens by itself. You let mm-hmm, something mm-hmm. take you over. So it's like inviting inspiration. It's like inviting creativity. Creativity without a goal of producing a piece of art, without a goal at all, so it's disinterested. I think there's a great space for that in children. just like in Africa, children, I'm sure, grow into an ability to go into that kind of trance. This leads to trance-like phenomena. I see it mostly happening in Brazil. I work at least a month in the year in Brazil, and my work has become there very important because there isn't so much a presence of psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
But what the equivalent is of therapy there is the Santeria, is African religion, different brands of it. And when I do things like Gestalt therapy, which is part of my program, where there's a lot of Gestalt ingredient, a strong Gestalt ingredient, in a broad sense of the word, which is it has to do with being in the present and with letting go, with a number of factors like that. People then go into states which are very different from other places of the world. It's as if Brazil is a place where consciousness can expand more readily. It's like a place for magic, a good place for magic. People go into altered states of consciousness in what normally would be considered therapy sessions, and they may contact the spirit of a grandfather who seems to be present to them right there, or to be in contact with a spirit-like entity, and the body goes into specific posture. Strange things, that because the African culture has brought that into their lives in the way that we might bring it more into the lives of children, that they learn to live into a subtle world that is as rich as the ordinary practical world. So it's a big field. Even therapeutic things like children disclosing what happens in their lives to each other. I don't think they should disclose in an educational setting to the teachers, because the teachers evaluate them. Teachers shouldn't have any way to control their privacy. But children among themselves could be given communication games where they come to know each other well and feel the common ground in their lives, what's happening in their homes, what's their experience, what are their pains, what are they proud of, what are they ashamed of, and so forth. They might learn to be more authentic than society has taught them thus far to be, at least among themselves, among their generation.
Yes. Thank you. I know that's just a start, but I feel from the start that when I create the curriculum that I will you'll be receiving a phone call from me, and you know, really I'm very interested and grateful for your input in this, because
lovely. I'm already past 77, so I like my ideas to be taken up. I'm aware of now leaving a heritage behind me, and it's when somebody like you can really make things happen. That's exciting.
So I'm aware that it's just past 8:30, so I'm going to have to close the call. Once again, I just wanted to remind people to come join us for the first World Spirituality Retreat here in the Bay Area in California. We have people coming from all over, just a few spots left. And most importantly, this particular call, Claudio, I received word from the beginning of the teleseries. I've been listening to the teleseries, and really I only knew about Claudio, and now you've introduced me to all these people, but it's a call that people are listening to from all over the world. And for me, it's just such a pleasure to have your friendship, but really your mentorship ongoing in these big projects that feel so large to take on, and yet you've taken them on your whole life, and it gives the inspiration for others to live big, and your life is really an exemplar of a world spirituality citizen, and also the inspiration that we can walk into these things and give it our everything. You know, and blaze through till the end of our days, as you do. So I offer my deep respects to you, and thanks for sharing with us tonight.
Well, it's wonderful to be appreciated. And I feel very grateful for the opportunity to be part of this too. And look forward to your questions when you go into that project. Anytime.
Okay. You're not done hearing from me. Okay, thank you, Claudio, and on behalf of all the listeners, I'm sure we'll be hearing also their thanks as well, so I'll extend that to you as well.
Well, my thanks to you too.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Bye.